This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This series contains adult language and depictions of graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised. In the spring of 1889, a young Irish couple, recently arrived immigrants from Dublin, welcomed a baby boy in their tiny, dirty tenement on Mulberry Bend in the infamous Five Points neighborhood of Manhattan. The boy, little Tommy Walsh, grew up tough and independent on the dangerous streets of late 19th century New York City, and, mostly out of survival and necessity, fell in with an even more dangerous crowd. Tommy was always a husky, I guess plus-sized gangster, and he became known by the incredibly unoriginal nickname, Fatty. I know, right? With all the cool, creative nicknames that various organized crime outfits are known for, they call an overweight guy Fatty? That just seems lazy. Anyway, in his early 30s, Fatty became a full-fledged member of the notorious Diamond Brothers gang. The leader of that particular gang, Jack Diamond, nicknamed Legs, not bad, Legs Diamond. Legs had just finished serving 2 years of a 5-year sentence for desertion during World War I, and realized that, while inside, everything on the outside had changed with the passing of the 18th Amendment, which prohibited the sale of alcohol in the United States, and the subsequent Volstead Act, which provided the necessary legal authority for federal enforcement of the new law. Basically, if you tried to sell any kind of alcoholic beverages, the federal government could break your door down and throw you in Leavenworth. Welcome back to The Devil Within. You're listening to Florida, Part 2. The Prohibition years, as they came to be known, would prove to be the most prosperous era in history for organized crime, because the gangsters knew that Americans were going to keep drinking. So the only issue would be figuring out how to get people their booze. And it was a bonanza. Bootlegging, rum running, illegal distillation, you know, these backyard stills, bathtub gin, secret imports from Canada, covert shipments from overseas, all organized by the mafia. It was a billion-dollar industry from day one. And one of the earliest and most successful financiers of the illegal alcohol trade during Prohibition was the gangster Arnold Rothstein. Fatty Walsh was employed as Rothstein's bodyguard for years. Now, Walsh's association with Rothstein is also where he befriended future mafia god Lucky Luciano. When Rothstein was murdered in November of 1928, both Walsh and Luciano were questioned regarding their possible involvement in the slaying. Although neither were ultimately charged, Walsh's reputation took a hit, as it was widely believed in the organized crime world that he was responsible for Rothstein's death, and therefore couldn't really be trusted on anybody else's payroll. In 1924, right around the time Fatty was teaming up with Rothstein's crew, builders were breaking ground on a massive hotel project in South Florida. Back then, Miami-Dade County, like much of Florida, was in the midst of the so-called Florida land boom of the 1920s. And a young developer named George Merrick acquired a large tract of land 7 miles southeast of downtown Miami, where he would build his dream city. Spanning more than 10,000 acres and consisting of gorgeous Mediterranean Revival architecture and meticulously planned zoning of commercial and residential areas, this new city was and remains among the most exclusive communities in the United States. It's called Coral Gables. The hotel that was begun in 1924 with the developer Merrick, along with hotel magnate John Bowman as the driving force, was the Miami Biltmore Hotel, part of the larger Biltmore chain of luxury hotels across the nation. The Miami Biltmore would be the jewel of the city for generations. The hotel opened in the middle of the Jazz Age and would play host to European royalty, Hollywood stars, and the upper crust of American society. Lavish balls and fashion shows, performances by aquatic artists in the hotel's iconic grand pool. Oh, and an incredible Donald Ross-designed golf course made the Biltmore the envy of nearly every property in the country. But then the Depression happened, followed by World War II, and the federal government took over the property and turned it into a military hospital for the duration of the war. And the Biltmore wasn't the only part of Coral Gables that was pressed into duty for that war. Hundreds of Navy pilots were trained and housed in the city of Coral Gables. After the war, the hotel remained a military hospital for returning wounded veterans until 1952, when the nearby University of Miami took over the building as its first medical school. In 1968, the university found a new location for its medical school, and the building became an empty shell, and subsequently, an opportunity for local vagrants and teenagers, like there's a difference, to break in on a regular basis. In 1983, the city of Coral Gables took ownership of the property and poured more than $55 million into a complete renovation, and the hotel reopened in 1987. But its recaptured glory would only last 3 years, as a massive economic downturn that affected the entire country caused the hotel to once again close its doors. But in 1992, Seaways Hotel Group acquired the property from the city and embarked on a 10-year, $40 million project to, I guess, renovate the earlier renovations. But it included returning the golf course and pool to their original glory. The hotel stands today as beautiful and elegant as the day she opened. But what does all this have to do with a gangster named Fatty? Well, after Fatty Walsh avoided arrest for the Rothstein murder in New York, he decided that he needed some sunshine and a change of scenery. South Florida, as we know, was booming, which meant there was money to be made in everything from gambling and prostitution to protection and bootlegging. Everything that landed squarely in the wheelhouse of a New York gangster. So, 3 months after the death of Rothstein, Fatty and a few of his former gang associates rolled into Coral Gables and took over the 13th floor of the Biltmore Hotel. The 13th floor was one large two-story suite of rooms in the hotel's iconic center Mediterranean-style tower. When the elevator stopped at the 13th floor, there was nowhere else to go but into the lap of luxury. And an illegal speakeasy, gambling den, and brothel. So aside from being among the 1% of hotels in the United States that actually has a 13th floor, most hotels think it bad luck to have a 13, and they go, as you know, from 12 right to 14. So the Biltmore had a 13th floor, and the 13th floor was responsible for just about any illicit activity that you can think of in the United States at the time. The 13th floor suite consisted of a great room, a library, it had a kitchen, and 4 bedrooms and about 5 bathrooms spread out, connected by a grand staircase. In March of 29, it was rented under the name Carl Gaylord, whom Walsh claimed to be working for, along with his associate Arthur Clark. Together, Walsh and Clark ran all the business on the 13th floor. Law enforcement was never able to find this guy named Carl Gaylord, and it's been assumed the name was fake and that it was actually the famous gangster Dutch Schultz who was actually running things. But if that's true, no one has ever given him up. Anyway, the illicit activities on the 13th brought in a lot of money and more than a few unsatisfied customers at the gaming tables. In In the early hours of March 7, 1929, three armed gunmen burst into the makeshift casino and opened fire. There were dozens of guests present, but the only people hit were Fatty and Arthur Clark. The patrons of the various offerings knew that when the bullets start flying, it's time to get the hell out of Dodge, and by the time the cops arrived, the place was empty, except for the body of Fatty Walsh and the groaning and wounded Arthur Clark, who had taken a bullet to the arm and a bullet to the chest. Clark would survive the attack, but never gave any description of the assailants or even hinted that he had any idea who might want them dead. Honor among thieves, I guess. It was surmised that the motivation behind the attack was a disputed gambling debt, but the case was never solved. They were looking at a few different suspects, including a man named Eddie Wilson, a low-level associate who supervised one of the gambling rooms in the suite. Wilson allegedly owed Fatty more than $8,000 in gambling losses. But Wilson fled to Cuba before he could be apprehended and questioned. It was then discovered that Wilson had actually hired an unassociated mob hitman named Joey Potatoes. See, now that's a nickname. But Potatoes had also fled to Cuba. One of the showgirls employed by Walsh in the suite later claimed that Wilson was indeed the shooter, but she would never testify, claiming, quote, "You'll never get nothing out of me. They'll kill me." So, normally, the story of Fatty Walsh and the Biltmore Hotel would end there. Another gangland murder surrounded by the trappings of high society. But, it would appear, Fatty Walsh decided to stick around the 13th floor of the Miami Biltmore Hotel after he died. So a few things to know about Fatty Walsh. He was violent. He had a quick temper. He was known to fly off the handle and punch someone in the stomach if he felt that they looked at him the wrong way. He was also prolific at paying off judges and claimed to have the entire judiciary of Miami-Dade County in his pocket. But mostly, he loved tall women with long legs. And that became evident in the years after his death. There are numerous stories of tall, beautiful women getting onto the elevator, hitting the button for, say, the 6th floor, only to have the elevator go all the way to 13. The doors would open, and regardless of how many times any of these women would press the door close button or the button for a different floor, anything to get the doors to shut, no luck. But as soon as the woman would exit the elevator, bang, the doors would magically close, and Fatty would have his temporary house guest. Invariably, these women would need to use the stairs to get to their floor, and they would mention hearing footsteps and laughter coming from various darkened rooms of the suite. And some even smelled cigar smoke, another pastime of Fatty's. But it's not just the ghost of Fatty Walsh that haunts the Biltmore.
Do you believe in ghosts? Spirits from beyond. Strange energy that lingers without explanation. Come with me and we'll explore the past and the present of one such place, which may in fact be a haunted house. Or should I say, a haunted hotel. The supernatural world may not be as far as you think. In fact, it may only be as far as the Coral Gables Biltmore Hotel. Let's take a look at its strange guest list.
The Biltmore Hotel began as the dream of George Merrill, the man who single-handedly created most of...
That was a clip from a wonderfully, totally 80s student film from the University of Miami student Kathy Baldock. Ms. Baldock was able to get some great interviews from self-proclaimed ghost hunters and psychics.
By 1978, reports of strange happenings had surfaced about the old building as Richard Weiner, author and expert on the occult, recalls his first visit.
He took us back there and took us in, and we took the elevator and going up the elevator, I noticed he had a gun on him. He had a walkie-talkie. And I said, what's all this? Well, some strange things going on here, and nobody goes in here usually alone or at night or without a weapon or communication with the outside.
Weiner took with him to the hotel five members of a spiritual group called the Arthur Ford Academy to hold a seance and investigate the ghostly rumors.
They had no idea where they're going. We just met them 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning and drove directly to the Biltmore. And right away they got vibes. And we went inside, they were getting them. I thought, you know, I don't know how much you know about it, but you know, the morgue used to be on the ground floor. And I thought, well, we ought to get some pretty good vibes here in the morgue. We took them down in the morgue and in the autopsy room, embalming room there, and nothing. Didn't pick up anything there, but by the elevator, they kept getting all kinds of feelings and vibrations and energy masses they were feeling. And we got up on the elevator, and each floor we stopped without getting off. And they stopped us at the 13th floor, which is also the 14th. And incidentally, probably 99 out of 100 hotels do not have a 13th floor. They go from the 12th to the 14th because it's bad luck. But the Biltmore does have a 13th, and the 14th is actually a balcony around the 13th. And they got in there and they picked up people dancing, black ties and gowns, furs, noises of gambling, roulette wheels, dice shaking. And this was all during a seance that we held. The seance was held on the 14th floor overlooking the 13th on the southeast corner of the building. And during the seance, all of a sudden, there were some Venetian blinds hanging from the windows. One of them, that's all, the whole thing, it didn't just drop and close. I mean, the whole thing fell right off the wall, the whole mass of shade down on the floor. And they didn't even budge, didn't even frighten them, didn't even, you know, react to it at all. And then they said there was a shooting. Somebody was killed here. Two people were shot. And first they picked up a knife, then they said, no, there was a gun. So two people were shot. And then they got off of that, and they got onto somebody tapping with a cane. We hear someone tapping with a cane like a blind man. Well, we didn't hear. We had a tape recorder going, two of them going at the same time then. And they picked up people, supposedly patients when it was a veterans hospital. So we got packed up our stuff and we're down to the elevator and got down to the lobby again. And they said, we're picking up something here in front of the elevator in the lobby like we did when we came in. And it's something to do with a shooting on the 13th floor. Well, that's all we had. So we got home that night and we were listening to the tapes, and all of a sudden we heard a real faint. Getting louder. And during that part of the seance, and we could hear them say they heard it. And they couldn't have touched those tape recorders because they were in the middle of the circle, and the circle was like about 10 feet in diameter. And we put the other tape recorder on. Well, maybe something wrong with it. Same thing. Exactly the same. We put them side by side and synced them, and the taps were exactly alike. And like they said, they saw the blind man with the robe, the dark robe, which they used to wear in the VA hospital. They used to wear kind of a dark purple robe at the time. And we got that on tape.
7 years later, in 1985, Weiner returned with two other psychics as the Biltmore was undergoing renovation, only to confirm that the spirits still lingered. Construction workers at the Biltmore confirmed this belief.
When I went back again 2 years ago when they reopened it, and I talked to the different workers there, and they were telling how the tools would disappear and then show up again, and the bloody knives they found in the between the walls when they were putting new pipes in, and the noises they heard that weren't pigeons.
Carolyn Constantino, one of the psychics who returned with Weiner, also believes the Biltmore is haunted.
I felt the presence first, and then I received clairvoyantly. I felt the person was murdered in front of the fireplace, and I also feel why the police could not access the building as quickly when they received their call. I felt where the hospital area was, which I think at this time is a dining room. And also, I was very attracted to the elevator.
So, if there are really phantoms in the Biltmore, why did they choose to lurk in this old building?
A person expires from violence, such as a murder, a rapid heart attack, an accident that happens just in a vehicle. That person doesn't mentally prepare themselves to make their transition from this plane of consciousness to the spirit plane of consciousness, and they get locked here. And this is why this goes on, because they haven't mentally, at the time of their transition, accepted that. And also people that are under drugs and they expire, or people that are under alcohol. And being involved in a speakeasy operation, I'm sure that person was well wrapped in that type of chemical. And this is why this has remained. Also, people that are very medicated with even prescribed medicine, and they're unconscious, don't realize that they've made their transition.
Another reason could be revenge. Somebody hell-bent on revenge. They were done in by someone or cheated by someone, and they decided they're not going over to the other side till they get that score settled. So there's any number of reasons why a person wouldn't want to go to the other side, and therefore they remain in this world.
Beyond the stories of Fatty Walsh, there's the story of the lady in red that supposedly has been spotted dozens of times in the grand ballroom, waltzing across the floor with her phantom partner, only to disappear before anyone can get a good look. Or the woman in white that has appeared in several different hotel rooms, scaring guests to the point that many have checked out, never to return. The story of this woman in white is that she allegedly committed suicide by jumping from one of the windows in the Biltmore Tower for reasons unknown. And now her spirit is doomed to haunt the place for eternity.
Well, you've traced the tragic history of the hotel, uncovered the story of Fatty Walsh, and heard what the experts have to say. Now you be the judge. Is the Biltmore Hotel just another beautiful landmark in Coral Gables? Or is it really the home of many uninvited, invisible guests? You decide.
Beyond the multitude of stories that include phantom babies crying, the sounds of a ghost jazz band playing at all hours of the night, and the random blinking of lights on the 13th floor, it was President Bill Clinton himself who claims that his time spent in the 13th floor suite was marred by his TV's inability to tune in to the Dolphins football game. A turn of events that he blamed squarely on Fatty Walsh. I'm just not sure which is more terrifying, missing the Dolphins game or actually watching them play. Thanks for listening. Make sure you're following The Devil Within wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. You can also check out our socials at The Devil Within Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Until next time, stay safe out there. The Devil Within is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Witkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.